This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, my name's Marcus Speller from the Football Ramble, and welcome to the Mixer Podcast. This is the fifth episode in an eight-part series to coincide with the release of The Mixer, a book written by one of our panellists, Michael Cox. The story of Premier League tactics from Route 1 to False Nines, of course, out now in hardback, ebook, and audiobook. This is to coincide with the Premier League's 25th season. The book charts the story of Premier League tactics over that period, and Michael will be joining me in each episode. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Marcus.
And we're saying hello again to Tom Williams of AFP. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Marcus.
And our focus today has moved on to the subject of wingers. Michael, this is a topic close to your heart.
Yeah, I fancied myself as a winger when I was a young boy. I had a ton of speed and I could cross, and that was pretty much it. And in those days, if you could do those two things, you were quite useful on the right of a 4-4-2. So
absolutely.
That was always my position, number seven.
If it was good enough for Mark Overmars, it would be good enough for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
No doubt we'll mention that Dutch winger in a short while. Tom, any particular favourite wingers immediately?
Like Michael, I consider myself a winger. I used to play on the left, but I was a right-footed left winger, so a sort of Franck Ribéry, Overmars, Robert Pires type.
That came in later, of course, in the English game, that kind of idea of the inverted winger.
Yes, yeah, well, I suspect that's probably something we're going to go on and talk about. But in terms of favourite wingers, generally the left wingers, Ryan Giggs, Mark Overmars, David Ginola, Robert Pires, who tended to play on the left at Arsenal, Kanchelskis. I think, you know, Kanchelskis, Giggs, the first Man United team that won the league and then won the league and the FA Cup the season after. And I think when you think back to that team, obviously we remember Cantona and his influence. But, you know, the sight of Giggs and Kanchelskis herring down the wings was their real calling card. And then, you know, the Newcastle team under Kevin Keegan, they were very sort of winger-focused, you know, Ginola on one wing and Keith Gillespie on the other. I think that was probably the golden age for Premier League wingers, because back in those days, if you were a left-footed winger, you played on the left and you got to the byline and put a cross in. And if you were right-footed, you played on the right and did the same thing. Whereas now we have the inverted wingers, and wingers these days tend to play in all different sorts of positions. You know, they play behind the number nine or as a false nine or something. Whereas back in the day, if you were a little skinny guy with a trick and a turn of pace, you would be on your wing and you'd get past the fullback and, you know, you'd get the ball in the box.
Very much so. And you've mentioned a fine collection of wingers there. Ryan Giggs leaps to mind, of course. One of the first ones you said. And here's a man who has seen the evolution of tactics throughout the league's history. And, of course, under Sir Alex Ferguson, who reinvented so many teams, and Giggs ended up playing as a more sort of deeper player in the centre. But in those early days, and for a long time, Michael, he was an out-and-out winger. And great pace and great flair to him. And was so exciting. One of the early stars of the Premier League era, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you go back and look at the early Premier League games, we're so used to almost every attacking player being really fast these days. Yeah. But at the time, Giggs was quite a phenomenon in terms of how quick he was. And the extent to which he changed his game over the course of his career is quite remarkable. He was so direct early on, so good at beating players. He was a funny kind of dribbler. He could do the tricks, but he was also just so good at knocking the ball past players and running onto it. And, as Tom was saying, a lot of Manchester United's attacks at that point came from getting the ball wide and just attacking down the flanks.
Yeah, and he was so direct at times as well. As Michael says, he did have a few little tricks, but not in the same way that, say, Cristiano Ronaldo would, perhaps. A bit unfair to compare him to maybe one of the greatest players that we've seen in recent years, certainly. But Giggs, that directness and that kind of in-and-out dribbling that he would do, and it's an obvious one to say, but the goal against Arsenal at the FA Cup semi-final, of course, that was just vintage Giggs in and out of those poor Arsenal defenders.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, one of the sensational FA Cup goals that we all remember. And it actually came at a time when Giggs wasn't doing that all that often.
Yeah.
I think, towards the latter half of the 90s, his hamstring problems you know, became more and more of an issue. And there was a time when even, you know, in the stands at Old Trafford, he wasn't particularly popular because he was very inconsistent. And I think once he'd got over the, you know, that those first few spectacular seasons where he scored a lot of goals, where he was very, very effective, there was a period where you sort of thought, you know, is he going to recapture those heights? And what happened instead was that he developed into a different sort of player, you know, and he ended up playing as this sort of string-pulling midfielder. But, yeah, I mean, obviously remember the Arsenal goal. Some of the goals he scored prior to that, when he was first sort of breaking into the team, there was a goal at Tottenham in the 92-93 season. Centre-back miscontrols a high ball. Giggs whips it off him. Nutmegs the next centre-back. Takes it around the keeper. Drills it in from a difficult angle. There's a goal at QPR the following season at Loftus Road. Yeah. Muddy little pitch. I think Ray Wilkins and Ian Holloway in centre midfield for QPR. And Giggs beats about six players. And then he had this really sort of nonchalant celebration thing. You know, he'd walk over to the corner flag and do a little twizzle of his index finger. And he was a real sort of boy wonder winger, the guy who could pick up and beat, you know, three or four, five players. And I think areas of his game were deficient. He wasn't a great crosser of the ball. His right foot for a long time was only good for standing on. And he would drift in and out of games. But I think when he was at his best, he was about as exciting a winger as I think Britain has produced when he was at, you know, when he was really at the peak of his powers.
Yeah, never really got on well with international football, though, did he, Ryan Giggs?
Yeah, I mean, I think he emerged at a slightly unfortunate time. I mean, Ryan Giggs was a member of the Wales team that came so close to qualifying for the 1994 World Cup. They had that pivotal last qualifier at home to Romania. November 1993 at the old Cardiff Arms Park, lost 2-1. And that was quite a decent Wales team. You had Ian Rush, Mark Hughes, Dean Saunders, Gary Speed was coming through at about the same sort of time. But over the years that followed, they all faded out of the picture and Ryan Giggs ended up being the sort of figurehead of this failing team. And it was a historic low point in the history of Welsh football. Bobby Gould came in as manager. They had all sorts of horrible kits. They lost 5-0 to Georgia, 6-4 to Turkey. I think they lost 7-1 to Holland at one point. And you just felt very sorry for Giggs a lot of the time because he was clearly the best player at Wales's disposal, but was having to go through all these abject humiliations. And he had a club manager, Alex Ferguson, who clearly wasn't all that fussed about him turning out for Wales as regularly as possible. He famously skipped all sorts of friendlies for various different reasons. And as a result, by the time he retired, he'd only got 60-odd caps. He was barely into double figures for international goals. And so I don't think the Ryan Giggs era is remembered that fondly by fans of the Welsh football team, whereas Gareth Bale had the great fortune of coming through at the same time as a really exciting bunch of players who all emerged through the ranks at the same time and went on and achieved that fantastic success at Euro 2016 together.
And we'll come to him a little bit later. Michael Giggs was probably a typical type of winger in those early Premier League years, certainly, although maybe his crossing wasn't as up to scratch as some others. But are there any others that spring to mind?
Well, I think the Blackburn team that won the title in 94-95 with Jason Wilcox and Stuart Ripley on either flanks, they were just such a kind of back-to-basics team, 4-4-2, essentially two target men up front in Shearer and Sutton, pretty much playing the same role. And there's some interesting stories, actually, from their training sessions in 94-95. I hadn't realised the extent to which Dalgleish basically didn't take any training sessions. It was all Ray Harford. Mm-hmm. And Ray Harford, of course, was known for his work at Wimbledon and Luton, quite direct sides, and just had them playing really direct football and only wanted them to cross from what he called the magic box, which was the width either side of the 18-yard box.
Right, okay.
So no deep crosses. He always wanted them to hit the byline, basically, be a classic winger. And there's a good story as well about how I think in March or April of that season, Dalgleish is scared that teams have basically worked out how predictable Blackburn are in terms of their crossing. And he says to Ripley, eventually they're just going to show you inside. So if they show you inside, where shall I get the strikers to stand for crosses from that point? And Ripley just looks at him really panicked. He's like, I don't know. I've never been in that situation before. So they literally only knew how to play one way. And that's kind of essentially what Premier League football was about at that point.
I mean, that is extraordinary, really, if you think about the evolution of tactics and so on, which, of course, is, you know, what the book is about. The fact that a player wouldn't know to cut inside and wouldn't know what to do there, and the manager saying, well, what should we do? I mean, I understand the tactic that get the ball in because you've got two forwards who can position themselves well and head the ball very, very well indeed and finish. But it is remarkable when you look back. And that won them a league title, of course. Absolutely incredible.
Yeah, and as Tom mentioned as well, you had the Newcastle team who nearly won the title the next year mm-hmm. with Ginola and Gillespie. And they were a relatively similar side. And in fact, even just after that, when they kind of paired Ferdinand and Shearer up front, and it was just all about crossing. It was, it's not a tactic you really obviously see teams crossing the ball, but you don't think of crossing sides these days, with the exception of, an Allardyce side or a Pulis side. Mm-hmm. Certainly none of the top teams play like that anymore.
As we just mentioned, the theme of the book is, of course, tactics. And there's a huge continental influence in the Premier League, as you document. And that resulted in the tactical development of each positions. Who would you say, Michael, that were the players that started that?
Well, I'd say David Ginola when he signed for Newcastle. I mean, he had such an immediate impact. His first month, he won Player of the Month. It was still a point where there weren't that many foreign players in English football. And he was really interesting because, I was amazed watching some of the videos, actually, how physically dominant he is. Mm. He used to receive the ball kind of back to the fullback, which you didn't see a lot.
Like a striker.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, players were usually getting the ball on the touchlines on the run, but he was backing in. And then he could spin either way. He could go inside and shoot. He could go down the outside and cross. And I think that was maybe the start. And with Marc Overmars as well, a player who could come inside and shoot very well, that was the start of us saying, hang on, wingers have got to be a little bit better than just hitting the byline and crossing. And Ginola was a player who could do either very well. He could shoot or cross equally well.
And Ginola sometimes was accused of being a little bit lazy. And this was a guy who, there was that famous story when he was on the team bus and went to light up a cigarette, and all the players scorned him, and Kevin Keane came over and went, I don't think we do that kind of thing here. I mean, okay, fine. And then of course later on the bus journey, they stop outside a chippy and all load up on fish and chips and pies and all the rest of it, which was perfectly okay. But even that little example there, as kind of silly as it is, shows you how different foreign players would do things to British players. And actually the Premier League, Tom, needed that foreign influence.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's like, one of the stories about Arsene Wenger's arrival at Arsenal and banning Mars bars. And I think it was on the bus back down to London after his first game at Ewood Park, and the players were all sitting at the back chanting, "We want our Mars bars." And that feels like it was an age away. But then, what was Paolo Di Canio get in trouble for at Sunderland, banning ketchup or something? So It seems that even though there's this feeling that when Arsene Wenger came in, things started to change. In many ways, in certain areas, there is still, progress to be made in that respect. It was a fascinating clash of cultures, I think. Wenger going in at Arsenal, who were this pretty well-established, tough bunch of old pros, really. And coming in with, various techniques he'd picked up when he was at Japan, and the individualised dietary programmes and these stretching routines, and Arsenal players having to get up early in the morning and stretch first thing, and then stretch before they leave the house, and all this sort of thing, and things that we now see as par for the course. And when it came in, it was completely revolutionary.
Yeah, and Michael, that Arsenal side, Wenger built on that battle-hardy Britishness at the back, and added some foreign flair. And Marc Overmars was crucial to that. Got the vital one away at Old Trafford in a 1-0 win, but scored so many vital goals and had so many vital contributions to that Arsenal team.
Yeah, and I think people sometimes forget how direct Arsenal were in those days. It's relatively recently that they became a kind of possession side, mm-hmm. holding the ball for long periods. They were renowned as a counter-attacking side. Mm. They had Overmars, they had Anelka up front. They had Ray Parlour on the right, who was, a very forward-thinking player, mm-hmm. just running always forward with the ball. Obviously, Bergkamp was stitching it all together. But Overmars, I must say, one of the nice things about doing all this research was kind of, I'd forgotten how good some players were. And Overmars was one of those players. Yeah. I think it's probably been overshadowed, maybe rightly, by Pires, who was, I'd say, equally fantastic, maybe even better. But that game at Old Trafford, he just ran the show, absolutely ran the show. He had four really good chances. Manchester United were playing a young lad called John Curtis at right back.
Oh, right.
He was very highly regarded at the time.
He had a torrid time against Omar.
Absolutely, yeah. And I'd say, I don't know whether this is responsible, but he never really recovered from that. Maybe he just wasn't quite at that level, but he had really, great prospects ahead of him. And Overmars was just electric the whole game, and probably should have scored more than one, mm-hmm. in fact. But it was incredible. Probably one of the all-time great Premier League performances, I'd say, considering that was the game that kind of tilted it in Arsenal's favour for the title.
And then went on to Barcelona as well, lest we forget Marc Overmars, proving what a great player he was. One of the Premier League's most famous players, of course, is David Beckham. Michael, do we consider him a winger?
I'd say he probably isn't a classic winger, but he was a funny one because he was just so based around crossing.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think he's a funny player, Beckham, because I think his kind of fame means that to people who are not massive football fans, he's probably slightly overrated. He wasn't ever one of the world's very best players. Mm-hmm. But I think people who kind of like to consider themselves knowledgeable about football would also kind of underrate him. You know, he was incredibly effective during that 98-99 season. And mm-hmm. even though, you know, he basically had one thing that was hitting the ball accurately over long distances, he could cross, he could score free kicks. He was a fantastic set-piece taker. Mm-hmm. And the way Manchester United played at that side, again, relatively primitive, 4-4-2. They had skulls, they had very good combinations up front, but they're basically about getting the ball wide, mm-hmm. attacking down the flanks. And Beckham was, I would say, probably the most important player, if, you know, certainly one of the most important players in that 99 side, which is probably one of the best sides the Premier League has seen.
Yeah, I mean, his replacement, Tom, if you like, was Cristiano Ronaldo for that number 7 jersey, the famous one. And we've mentioned 4-4-2 quite a bit, you know, classic wingers, that kind of thing. But as time went on, we saw the introduction more of a 4-3-3, which is something that in this country, you expected that from Barcelona, you know, from Cruyff's dream team and so on and so forth. But someone like Cristiano Ronaldo was one of those players, and always has been. To call him a winger, you can do, and certainly in his early days, but he's more of a forward, if you know what I mean. And this signalled maybe a changing in preferences and formations in the Premier League, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Alex Ferguson had always been fairly tightly wedded to 4-4-2. I mean, he generally played with a front man and a guy who was a bit more multifaceted playing just off him. But I think Ronaldo's emergence and Ferguson's appreciation of Ronaldo's brilliance meant that he realised he had to rebuild the team in order to get more from Ronaldo. When he first came into the team, obviously he was given the number 7 shirt and he'd play on the right quite often, but as we've seen, you know, during latter years at Real Madrid, he is much happier on the left, cutting in and onto his right foot. And you look at the Man United team that won the 3 Premier League titles in a row, won the 2008 Champions League, reached the final the following year, and the front three of Rooney, Ronaldo and Tevez, who operated with a large amount of freedom. Wayne Rooney was basically sort of farmed out to the left in order to make room for Ronaldo, to give him the freedom to go and pick up the positions that he wanted to take up. And I think in many ways, you know, Ronaldo was in the vanguard of this wave of multifaceted modern forwards who are very hard to define. An awful lot of the most exciting players in the game these days, you can only say that they're forwards because they can play on the wing, or they can play as a number 10, or they can play as a false 9, or they can play as a central striker. And I think Ronaldo was one of those. He arrived and, you know, he appeared to be a winger. He did things that wingers did. He threw step overs, probably a few too many. He tormented fullbacks. He put crosses in. He scored the odd goal. But once it became apparent that there was so much more to his game, I mean, a phenomenal header of the ball. Yeah. I don't think I've seen anyone attack a ball as impressively as Ronaldo. Mm. Wonderful finisher. And as a result, now we are now used to this idea of a forward player not having any, you know, sort of set position, or maybe having a starting position. Mm-hmm. Ronaldo's going to start on the left, but with the knowledge that he'll drift in. And he was one of the first players I think we'd seen in England who played and was given that sort of freedom.
Yeah, and Michael, do you think that Cristiano Ronaldo and the way Ferguson used him, did that change the template? Because it's all very well for a club like Manchester United to sign a player like Cristiano Ronaldo. They get the best players, you know, and Ferguson, one of the best managers, can switch it up tactically. But did that set a template for perhaps the rest of the league to say, hang on, maybe the 4-4-2 and the traditional wingers, we have to mix that up as well if we want to challenge or do something in the league?
Yeah, I mean, I think Manchester United's evolution during that period is really interesting. I mean, Ferguson made the decision that he was going to move away from 4-4-2, went towards a 4-5-1 system with Van Nistelrooy up front.
Mm.
But then what he kind of discovered during Van Nistelrooy's time was that moving to 4-5-1 wasn't that one man should be dominating the goals.
Mm-hmm.
It was that goals had to come from all over the team.
Mm.
And I don't think it's any coincidence whatsoever that Ronaldo's improvement, and indeed Rooney's improvement to a certain extent, came after Van Nistelrooy left in 2006. And that gave them the license to kind of rotate positions. It meant that the goal scoring was shared between lots more players. And yeah, I mean, as Tom was saying, there's so many of the best players in the world now can play multiple roles. They can play up front, they can play wide, they can play as a number 10. And Ronaldo, I think, was just so impressive because it felt like every year he'd just add something else to his game. You know, he started out as you know, he was quite derided really for his stepovers and stuff and for going down too easily. And, you know, the thought of that now is just ludicrous, because I mean, when was the last time you saw Ronaldo do a trick or anything unnecessary? He's become so efficient and so ruthless in terms of his goal scoring. And as Tom said, you know, he was great in the air. He became a great free kick taker. He was scoring kind of scrappy goals as well, which you don't think he would be doing in the first few seasons. It was just a remarkable evolution. No other player in the Premier League era has improved by so much from when they came to when they left. It was quite incredible. You know, kind of took it for granted at the time, but he was derided at the start, and by the end, he was the best player in the world.
To put you on the spot quickly, is he the best player in the Premier League's era, do you think?
I think he got to the greatest level. I think he maybe didn't quite have the longevity of some of the others, but I think, you know, he won World Player of the Year. He was the best player in the world, and in that sense, he was the best player the Premier League has seen. Yes. Mm-hmm.
No, interesting. Well, also, I mean, mentioning wingers earlier, becoming a bit inverted, going away from that traditional, the guy with the left foot plays on the left and vice versa. Even clubs lower down the league, such as Roy Hodgson's Fulham, played with inverted wingers. I mean, Damien Duff on the right, and would it have been Clint Dempsey perhaps on the other side?
Dempsey, well, sometimes Simon Davis.
Simon Davis as well, yeah. It was fascinating to see these trends usually start at the top. Not always, but usually, as is the case. But to see that go throughout the league, with some of the sides lower down trying out these inverted wings, is quite an interesting evolution as well.
Yeah, I think Fulham's Europa run in 2010 is one of the great forgotten things of the last few years. Maybe because Hodgson's fallen out of favour and, you know, wasn't so popular with England, but the sides they got past on the way to that final was just absolutely incredible to beat Juventus. They got past Shakhtar Donetsk, who'd won it the previous season, Hamburg as well, some really big sides. And, Damien Duff's an interesting one because he started out as a classic left winger in the Giggs mould. And then played so much on the right that he says now in interviews when he's playing five-a-side. In fact, there's some nice stories of him just playing five-a-side on his own in Pitchers and Island just because he wanted to kind of run around. But he says he now prefers kicking the ball with his right foot, which is incredible considering how left-sided he was. But that's the extent to which wingers had to evolve their game. Obviously, he was still cutting inside from the right. Mm-hmm. But he had to show that he could go down the line to make sure he wasn't predictable. Which other players in his mould, of course, don't do.
Yeah.
But the fact that he could switch from being a left-footed player to, he says now, a predominantly right-footed player is quite remarkable.
That really is, and of course played in that 4-3-3 that Jose Mourinho often played at Chelsea at times. Mentioning players becoming more sort of forward players rather than, say, out-and-out wingers, and talking about Cristiano Ronaldo, it would be remiss if we didn't mention his Real Madrid teammate Gareth Bale. Of course, had a great time at Spurs. Started off as a fullback, Tom, went to that kind of left winger position, and is now one of those sort of world-class forwards that we love watching.
Yeah, I mean, when he came through at Southampton, he played at left-back. When he got into the Wales team, he played at left-back and made his debut when he was about 17. And for a while, there was a lot of talk about where he would end up. I mean, you know, he was clearly someone who has always had extraordinary physical capacities. But the thinking was, you know, might he turn into one of these rampaging fullbacks in the style of a Dani Alves or a Maicon, perhaps, you know, someone who just sort of motors up and down the flank all day. And we forget now, it gets mentioned every now and again, but when he first went to Tottenham, he had a really difficult time. Harry Redknapp didn't really fancy him, was always having a go at him for faffing around with his hair on the training pitch. And he only got into the Spurs team for any decent length of time because Benoit Suakoto got injured at one point. Bale went into the team, played well, finally ended that run of matches that he'd been on the losing side for, and then Redknapp started trying him out further forward. And, you know, of course he had his great breakthrough game at the San Siro against Inter Milan when he scored that incredible hat-trick, completely ripped Maicon to pieces at a time when Maicon was seen as, you know, pretty much the world's best right-back with Dani Alves, and then repeated the dose when Inter Milan came to White Hart Lane, you know, set up a couple of goals by burning past Maicon, and then I think once he'd sort of demonstrated what an impactful player he could be, he was given more and more freedom under Redknapp and then under Andre Villas-Boas. And by the end of his time at Spurs, he was basically playing wherever he wanted to. He was playing through the middle and absolutely ripping teams to shreds on his own. And, you know, he's not been given quite the same freedom at Real Madrid, tends to play more off the right. I mean, Rafa Benitez tried him out playing him behind the centre forward, and it didn't really work. But again, he has become one of these multifaceted modern forwards, much like Ronaldo, who's someone who, you know, he clearly bases his game on quite a lot.
And we've talked a lot about these great forward players who are playing on the wings. As a winger is obviously a forward-thinking position among the goals, among the assists. There's also defensive work to be done. Now, we don't associate defensive work with someone like Cristiano Ronaldo or Gareth Bale, even though their work rate is very, very high. But there was the rise of defensive wingers, Michael, if you will. The likes of Dirk Kuyt and even Ji-Sung Park as well at Manchester United, who their all-round game was actually doing all the doggy work as well, not just having a few touches and running down the wing. They would need to get back in those systems.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've talked about the rise of attacking fullbacks already, and this was a kind of response to that, I suppose. Some of those big Champions League games in the mid-2000s when English sides were essentially dominating European competition, there was nothing really much going on in the midfield zone. It was very defensive in there. You had a lot of players, you know, there was the Makaleli role. There was kind of a big shift towards just being very solid in the centre of the pitch. And teams relied so much upon their attacking fullbacks that you had someone like Park Ji-sung, who probably wouldn't be a regular if Manchester United were, you know, at home to Bolton or Blackburn in a game that was, you know, all about them scoring as many goals as possible. But when it came to kind of nullifying an Ashley Cole or Gael Clichy or, you know, an attacking fullback at any big side, mm-hmm. Park was incredible, just was so instrumental in so many of those Manchester United performances. And of course, was very good going forward as well. You know, his part in counter-attacking goals they scored at the Emirates. Ronaldo got a famous one in the Champions League. Wayne Rooney as well scored one at the Emirates. He was not the most spectacular player, and I think probably reined his game in. You look at how he played at PSV, it was actually very exciting, a little bit of a kind of in the early Ronaldo mold of stepovers and sending the fullback the wrong way. But it, you know, the way he adjusted his game often when he was playing on the opposite side of Ronaldo to Ronaldo to provide the balance, I think was really interesting.
And we see a lot of these wingers who are now all-rounders, if you like, as well. Someone like Alexis Sanchez, who, you know, great work rate at Arsenal. Again, would you call him a winger? Riyad Mahrez, perhaps, for Leicester, Tom?
Yeah, Riyad Mahrez is a bit of a throwback, I suppose. I guess the big difference in his positioning is that he plays on the right. I think if he'd come through 20 years ago, in the early days of the Premier League, he would have been a left winger. And his job would have been to beat the fullback on the outside and get a cross in. Whereas he's a pretty classic inverted winger these days. Plays very wide, out on the right, very high up, and can go both ways. You know, he can use his right foot, but he, you know, his preference is to come in onto his left foot. And he's got that Arjen Robben / Messi thing of, even though everyone in the stadium and everyone watching at home and everyone on the pitch knows he just wants to get the ball onto his left foot and shoot, somehow he always manages to do it. And, you know, I think that says a lot about his ability to sow doubt in the mind of the opposition fullback and the opposition defenders. Because you know Mahrez wants to go on his left foot, but every now and again he'll go on his right foot and he'll go on the outside and then check back inside and then maybe go outside again. You look at him and Mark Albrighton, and they're about as classic a wing pairing as we've seen in English title winners in recent years, with the one difference, I suppose, compared to traditional pairs of wingers, is that they play on the opposite flanks.
I think the winger position is quite an obvious one that shows the development of tactics and how that's changed throughout the years from 20 years ago, even further back to now. So as always, to finish off, Michael, I want you to pick one player that you would say was a game changer, who was potentially a revolutionary in this role in English football.
I think it's Ginola, actually. I mean, Ronaldo obviously took things to a new level, but I think he was just such an exceptional talent. He was almost unique. Maybe Bale, you could say, was in his mould. But the fact that Ginola was going both ways, I think, really threw opposition right-backs in the early stage. And I think that's when you had that massive shift from the Ripley and Wilcox, who just didn't know how to come inside, to wingers who were actually multi-dimensional, could score goals. He wasn't the best at tracking back, Ginola, it must be said. But apart from that, he was a really good all-round attacker.
Yeah, Tom, you would agree?
Yeah, it's hard to single one out. I mean, you know, clearly of the players we've talked about, Cristiano Ronaldo was the outstanding talent of the Premier League era, but then didn't spend that much time playing purely as a winger. I think there's a decent case to be made for Ginola. I think another one, I think the way that Arsene Wenger used Robert Pires was in a similar vein. I mean, Pires didn't have the athleticism that Ginola did, but he was probably a slightly more inventive player. I think he could play at a lower pace. You know, Ginola was very much, everything was done at high speed, and I think, you know, Pires was one of those players, played out on the wing, on his opposite foot, encouraged to come inside, combined with the centre midfielders, combined with Dennis Bergkamp, with Henri, and I think he was a really important part of the way that Arsenal team played.
And lest we forget the moment, then David Ginola took his top off playing for Aston Villa to show John Gregory that he was still very much ripped and could do it at that level. And I think that's a wonderful moment to end on. Give us a nice visual thing there. Thanks very much for listening to this episode of the Mixer podcast. Michael Cox is the Mixer, is the story of the Premier League tactics from Route 1 to False Nines, out now in hardback, ebook, and audiobook. I'm Marcus Speller. Thanks very much to Michael Cox and Tom Williams for joining me. Please join us next time for our sixth episode, when we'll be turning our attention to the number 10s.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.